Welcome into episode 144. That number divisible by 12, right? That's a special number, at least to younger Alex. Anyway, I don't know. There's something weird about 144 that I found really interesting. How are you doing, Chris?
Well, I'm not quite as interested in 144, but it does feel like a nice milestone because I was looking at the doc template, which we updated at episode 100. And so we've done 44 episodes since the last iteration on the template. We always tweak every episode anyways, but I thought that was kind of noteworthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're creeping up on 150 now, huh?
I feel like all of the small talk is to avoid the disastrous week that you've had.
Oh, it's like, been bad.
I just see hints, and I feel like there's a story here.
Well, if I told you it ended up with a dash to Micro Center in Charlotte because my server died.
Oh.
No. It'll give you some idea of the seriousness of the situation.
Oh, no. Oh, no. That's never good, too, because you're always going with what they have in stock.
Actually, that turned out to be... We'll get to that. So,
okay, good. Okay.
Late last week, I was filming a video for work, and I was talking about self-hosted AI stacks. So, you know, Ollama, running local models with OpenWeb UI, like we talked about in the last episode on this show. And I thought to myself, you know what would be really nice is if on camera, if I had a prop in my hand of the GPU that I'm talking about, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to run down to the basement, power off the server, pull the graphics card, run back up, film a segment, put the graphics card back in, bada bing, bada boom. No big deal.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Yeah, the server didn't turn back on again.
Oh, no.
All I did was pull the graphics card. Like, I've pulled PCIe cards 8,000 times in my life. I didn't do anything wrong or anything different.
Let me ask you, did you rub your feet on the carpet before you touched the machine? I mean, like, what do you think happened? Just died? Do you think, what?
Well, it was a real pickle of a issue to try and diagnose at first. Because I've got IPMI for this box, you know, because it's a Supermicro motherboard. It is an Epic server. So it's the one I made a YouTube video about a year ago. You know, it's a monster. It's got a 7402 Epic chip in it, 256 gigs of RAM, tons of NVMe storage, you know, the works, really. And I thought, right, I'm just going to log into the IPMI and power it on that way. Because I thought to myself, I pushed the power button before I came back upstairs, didn't I? Yeah, I did. It's like one of those things. Did I lock the car?
Yeah. Did I leave the stove on?
And I'm back at my desk waiting for it to come back up in the Proxmox cluster. And I'm like, where are you? Where are you, bud? Like, hello?
Yeah, I mean, I know it takes a while to post, but come on. Let's go.
So then I pulled up PyKVM and I'm like, there's nothing there.
Dead signal.
No VGA output. And I'm like,
uh-oh.
So at that point, I'm like, okay, I've probably misplugged something in, or I've didn't push the power button or whatever. IPMI, then I logged into the IPMI of the box itself, not just PyKVM, wasn't reading any sensors or anything. I could still log in, but it wasn't initialized properly. So I'm like, huh, that's weird. Never seen that before. So then I headed down to the basement, had a look. The fans were spinning, sure enough, powered on. So I'm like, right, I'm pull it out of the rack, get it on top of the rack and have a look at it. And there was a little LED blinking on the motherboard it's named M1 LED. So I tapped that into Google and had a little look and came across, there's a link in the show notes, to a Serve the Home thread. It may as well be called Serve the Home of Alex's server is dead. Serve the Home of death.
Yeah,
it turns out that there is, I have the revision 1.1 of this H12 SSL-i motherboard.
Okay.
And it turns out that the area right underneath where all the PCIe cards, you know how the shape of a PCIe card, you've got the slot on the board and then there's a gap between the plastic slot and the back of the motherboard.
Yeah, sure.
There's sometimes some chips in there, you know, like audio chips and things like that, that they just use that dead space for. Well, on this motherboard, that's where the BMC and all of its gubbins lives. And it turns out it's extremely sensitive to any kind of overheating or any kind of PCIe devices knocking capacitors off the board, that kind of thing. That's what this thread was kind of pointing me towards.
And you've been doing both, right? I mean, this thing's been cooking. on AI tasks and, you know, pulling it in and out, anything could have happened in there.
Yeah. So I got my camera out and took some really high res pictures because, you know, my eyes are getting old and I can't see, and had a good look. And so far as I can tell, I've done absolutely nothing physical to the board. So when you start looking deeper in the thread, there's a bunch of guys getting multimeters out and measuring capacitance and resistance. And you're just like, oh, I just can't. Because these are tiny, tiny, tiny little, like, they're smaller than a grain of rice, some of the SM surface mount components on this board. So yeah, she's dead, Jim. The Epic server, the motherboard, Supermicro, piece of garbage, is dead.
Man, you hate to see something like that take out a whole system. Right. It's such a simple design mistake. I know space is tight on those boards, but those PCI cards, I mean, what kind of PCI card are you putting in a server that probably isn't getting hot?
Yeah.
Right. And it's going to be, I mean, the reason why those slots are there is because people take things in and out. It's just,
you see people in this thread, they put Kapton tape over the top of the chips that are there and foam and all sorts of stuff. And I'm just like, man, there are some people in the thread too that have actually had Supermicro RMA the board successfully, but I'm not sure if I'm going to have much luck with that given I bought it 13 months ago from a Chinese eBay seller, you know.
Yeah, I suppose not. You've got a dead system and you've figured out it's probably this, so this is where I imagine the trip to the store comes in.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not one to waste a crisis. You know what I mean? Like, it's a chance for an upgrade, of course. I mean, actually, it's funnily enough, I was talking with Stephen, you know, the guy up in Toronto, talking about how a few weeks ago that I was finding the Epic 7402 single thread performance a little bit slow for things like Windows virtual machines and what have you. Just the single thread performance just wasn't quite where I wanted it. And I was kind of looking around on eBay going, oh, maybe I could spend a little bit and get a faster CPU, and nah, the one I've got works just fine, and kind of put that one on ice. And then I said to myself, right, once the attic is done and you can film it properly, you can make a proper content series out of it, you're allowed to spend some money. Until then, just sit on it. Yeah, so that kind of went out the window. The attic's still not done. they've painted it at least up there, but we don't have any carpet yet. Don't have any AC or HVAC up there yet. So, you know, progress in progress. So I sort of looked around at the options I've got, and Epic chips, the newer ones, still look fantastic. But again, the single core performance of an Epic chip is, well, they're designed to be multi-core, multi-thread workload chips. They're not designed to be like desktop, you know, they're just not fast single thread performance systems.
Sure.
So I thought, well, what about if I went for like a modern Ryzen, like an AM5, like a 9950X or something like that, that's got loads of threads, can run at 5 gigahertz, take lots of RAM, all the rest of it. Trouble is, they just don't have enough PCIe lanes from what I'm wanting to do. Like, I've got a pair of U.2 NVMe SSDs. I've got, I think, about 6 M.2 SSDs in there for things like caches as I'm doing video editing off the server over the network, you know, app data for all my containers, and just a bunch of stuff going on in there. Not to mention an NVIDIA GPU and the Intel Arc Pro GPU and a 10 gig SFP plus network card. So there's a lot going on in there.
Yeah. You legitimately need to be thinking about the PCI lanes.
So I sort of went to Perplexity and Claude and sort of said, you know, hey, what are my options and how many lanes do I actually need? And where, you know, just trying to talk it through with someone, you know, AI doing whatever it's doing. And I didn't expect this really from Perplexity, but it came out with, well, why don't you look at Threadripper? And I'm like, Threadripper? I've heard of that. I've heard Wendell talk about Threadripper. Maybe I should look at Threadripper.
Right, sure.
It turns out it's kind of this nice middle ground between an AM5 desktop chip and the Epic kind of massively multi-threaded server grade chip. It's basically a high-end desktop workstation chip.
And I assume it's got the lanes you need?
It does indeed. So the Threadripper Pro 5955WX is what I ended up going with. And in the end, I ended up picking that because Micro Center had it in stock. In Charlotte, which is a 2.5 hour drive for me, you know.
So that's 16 cores, 4 gigahertz?
Yeah, 16 cores, 32 threads, supports up to 2 terabytes of DDR4 memory.
Oh, all right.
That's another thing. I could reuse the existing memory from my Epic build with the Threadripper Pro because it's still using DDR4. And then I thought, right, well, what's the use of having a CPU without a motherboard? I've got to find a motherboard in stock.
Great.
Microcenter carried that too.
Ah.
There's an Asus, what's the model number of this thing? WRX80 Sage Pro Wi-Fi 2 motherboard.
Sounds like a Subaru.
Oh, dude, have you seen this thing?
Yeah, this is, it looks like a tank. I mean, it is slick looking, just beautiful.
It's what motherboards all wish they were.
This is like a tactical motherboard is what it is.
Okay, so let me read off the specs because this thing, it's packing some heat. First of all, it takes the Threadripper Pro CPU. It's an extended ATX or EATX motherboard with dual 10 gigabit LAN. We're talking RJ45, not SFP Plus, unfortunately, but I'll take what I can get. It's built in. Loads of USB 3.2 Gen 2x2 Type-C ports. God, I wish they'd fix the naming of USB, really.
Yeah.
And here's where it starts to get really tasty. 7 Gen 4 x16 PCIe slots.
There you go.
Seven. Yeah.
Seven of them.
Seven. Yeah.
That's nice.
And they can individually bifurcated. Which means, because this board ships with one of the Asus Hyper M.2 cards, that means theoretically, dear listener, I could put 7 times 4 M.2 cards in those PCIe slots and have 28 M.2 SSDs, NVMe SSDs, running at full bandwidth.
I mean, this sounds like a YouTube video. I mean, come on. Right? There's got to be a reason.
Yeah, if I'm made of money. Yeah, right. It also has a pair of U.2 connectors on board, as well as 3 onboard M.2 Gen 4 slots as well.
And a built-in Asus ASM B9 IKVM for remote management.
Exactly. Yeah, it's got a IKVM built right in. Not that I don't really need it with PyKVM these days, but sure is nice to have.
It is, especially like when you're, you know, in the situation you were just in. It's nice to have that one other thing to be able to check in on.
Absolutely. I mean, it's packing so many PCIe slots that it's got 2 6-pin auxiliary power inputs to make sure that those 7 slots have enough juice to, because I think the slots can each provide 75 watts and then the cards have extra cables that go into them to give them more power. But it's just a ridiculous motherboard. Honestly, it's by far the nicest motherboard I have ever owned. It's beautiful.
Be interesting to know how long this one lasts. You know, because this could last a long time.
Funny you should say that, because the guy at Microcenter actually managed to successfully upsell me on their service plan.
You got the service plan?
Yeah, dude. Okay, let me explain. Okay. Let me explain.
All right. Okay.
So, okay. There's no easy way to say this, but the motherboard was $900.
Yeah, it is an expensive motherboard. Yeah.
The CPU was $1,000.
Yeah.
My budget for this upgrade was $2,000. So I'm like, okay. All right. Because I can reuse the RAM. Begrudgingly, of course. I mean, deep down inside, 17-year-old me is going, ha, look at this thing, it's amazing, whilst my credit card's quivering in fear in my back pocket.
Unraid.net/self-hosted. Now is the time to check it out. The new Unraid 7 is out, and Unraid is a trusted, powerful, easy-to-use operating system for self-hosted servers and for anyone who just needs to solve network-attached storage. Like most of you out there, you've probably got stuff on hand already, maybe different size drives or different manufacturers. Unraid can handle that. And with Unraid 7, they've now rounded out all the ZFS capabilities. I'm talking full capabilities with full integration, hybrid ZFS pools that support a wide range of special VDEV types, great VM management that snaps in with all of that. And Unraid has integrated Tailscale, so you can now natively install it along with different Docker applications, so you can put the container directly on your tailnet. It's packed with game-changing new features that just make it easier to get started and improve and really refine what's already been there. You hear us talk about so many cool projects, and I know all of us, our privacy is a priority, especially people that listen to this show. But these things require time and a commitment. Unraid can be your secret tool, your weapon to get started and get going. You know, sometimes for me, like, an impending trip just gets that last bit of, oh my gosh, I got to get this done over the hurdle kind of thing for me. And, you know, Unraid can be a tool that can let you get going right away with the stuff you already have on hand. And with the new Unraid 7, it's time to take a look again because things are just really, really humming over there. And, you know, I don't even talk about this very often, but like there's just been a lot of small improvements under the hood to like the Samba file services and NFS. And of course, just to the UI to the dashboard. So it's worth a new look if you've already checked out Unraid before. And if you're ready to get started on a project, take advantage of the data security it offers. Support the show by going to unraid.net/self-hosted. That's unraid.net/self-hosted.
Because I was buying a CPU cooler as well, which, by the way, MicroCenter carry a CPU cooler in stock to go with a random esoteric Threadripper Pro CPU. Like, they are just god tier as a store. I mean, if you've never been to a MicroCenter, it's just like, for someone like me, it's like going to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. They've got 3D printers out on the shop floor running. They've got UniFi switches and Wi-Fi access points you can literally buy in the store. They've got all of their PC cases out, and you can literally look at them outside of the packaging and be like, huh, I don't like the way that that thumb screw, whatever, you can touch it and feel it and see it in 3D space.
So you're making me jealous. We don't have one in Washington.
Oh, if you ever get the chance, if you're ever in the neighborhood of a MicroCenter, it's well worth going. It's just great. It was a great experience. But anyway, the sales associate that I spoke to was like, you're buying most of the parts for a build here. Because I also picked up a new power supply because I'm like, well, the Threadripper Pro can pull a bit of extra juice compared to that Epic chip. So I upgraded from an 850 to a 1200 watt power supply in the process too. And he was like, right, so you're buying a cooler, a power supply, a motherboard, and a CPU. That's basically most of a build, isn't it? So he called his manager over and was like, can we sell this guy the desktop plan? And I'm like, what's the desktop plan? From putty in his hand at this point. And he goes, well, if you wanted to cover just the motherboard for I think it was 3 years, it's like $270. And I'm like, not interested. And then he goes, well, on the desktop plan, and this would cover everything you're buying here, not anything, you know, that you already have, but anything you buy from us today is $350 or something. And I'm like, all right, okay, well, tell me, what does it cover? And apparently it covers accidental damage. It covers manufacturing defects. It covers like literally everything that could go wrong with it, bar theft, I think. And so to claim on this thing, all you do is take it back to the store, which, you know, for me, MicroCenter's 2.5 hours down the road. Okay, that kind of sucks, but it could be worse. And he said, well, so let's say hypothetically in 2.5 years, something happens and you bend a pin in the socket or one of the RAM slots stop working or whatever, you can bring it back to us, anything that you've bought on the table, and we'll give you store credit for the full value of what you've paid today, not what it would be worth, you know, if you resold it or whatever. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, that seems actually like quite a worthwhile insurance policy.
Yeah, I could see it, especially after the experience you just went through, right?
Yeah, I'm still bruised and he's offering me a way out. I'm like, do you sell this for eBay purchases too?
Well, and like if something, not that it's likely to, but if something did go wrong, you're like, well, then I'm out another $2,000 again.
Yeah. Like, well, I'm not suggesting I'm actually going to do this, but it'd be an awful shame if that motherboard stopped working in 2.5 years, wouldn't it?
Yeah, something just happens.
I don't know. Pipe burst or something. God, that would be awful.
Yeah, probably design defect just caught up with it eventually.
So I purchased all this stuff and I didn't fancy driving all the way back to Raleigh just to find out that something was DOA. So me, wife, kid, we made a weekend trip out of it. Ella got a hotel sleepover. And then Catherine and I, we sat in the other half of the hotel room because we got one of those ones that has like two rooms, like a Hilton Home 2 or something.
Oh, nice.
And I built the computer in the hotel room.
You know what? That's not a bad idea. I never would have thought of that. Would you imagine? Yeah, like if you'd gotten home and it didn't work?
Yeah, I would have been pissed. Yeah, but the best part was I had my old server in a suitcase.
Ah.
So I'm walking past the check-in desk with this massive suitcase full of a server.
They think it's closed and you're on a trip.
Right. And then I just, you know, get to my hotel room and I whip out this epic server with, you know, because I could just reuse the RAM and what have you.
So you brought like screens and keyboards and everything?
No. You see, this is where it gets interesting.
Uh-huh.
I have an HDMI capture device over USB-C, don't I? For all of the recordings I do for work. So I just brought my Camlink 4K and use that.
And just use a laptop screen as like a pass-through screen.
Yeah, with OBS, yeah.
Yeah. And he thinks you don't have to pack a screen, right?
I mean, if it works, it ain't stupid, right?
Obviously, you got it done.
So there we go. Currently, the server, I haven't actually touched it since we got home. It's as we record, it's Monday evening. We got back yesterday on Sunday, and I've just been so busy at work today. Like, I want to record a video of actually swapping the guts over and all the rest of it for my YouTube channel, and I just haven't gotten to it yet. So currently, I dashed all the way to Charlotte to get it over the weekend whilst I had a window of time before we go to scale and all the rest of it, and it's still sat there, and I haven't really, I mean, it posted in the hotel room successfully, so I know it works, but currently the server's offline still.
Tailscale.com/self-hosted. You got to go there, check it out, support the show, and get it for free for up to 100 devices, 3 users, and no credit card required. Tailscale is modern networking that connects your devices and your applications directly to each other. It's great for companies, and it is great for self-hosters as well. I'm talking secure remote access to whatever it might be that you need, and it's really fast, and it's protected by WireGuard. When I'm traveling and I bring Tailscale with me, it's like I bring my entire LAN with me. I've preloaded a little Apple TV set-top box that has a fantastic Tailscale app that's connected to my Tailnet. And when I get to the Airbnb, I'm going to plug it into the HDMI port on the TV, power up the Apple TV, and I'll be streaming everything just like it was in my living room. Literally like the Apple TV was in my living room. And I'm going to be in an Airbnb in California. I'm talking easy to deploy. I'm talking zero config. I'm talking no fuss VPN that puts all your nodes on a flat mesh network. And then you have the power to control that with things like ACLs and user authorization. And you can tie it in with your corporate authorization system as well. You got to play with this because it will change your game. I literally have no inbound ports on any of our production corporate systems or my personal systems. It's the way it really should be. And when you go to tailscale.com/self-hosted, you get the 100 devices for free forever for 3 users. You can take it further if you want, but you might find that's a great plan just for you. And thousands of companies like Instacart, Hugging Face, Duolingo, and Jupiter Broadcasting have switched to using Tailscale as well. Business plans, personal plans, and that free 100 device plan. All you got to do is go to tailscale.com/self-hosted. Go see why I've been raving about it. I love it, and it's changed how I do networking. Much, much better. tailscale.com/self-hosted.
You seem to be on a crusade for sensors and smart home upgrades. What's driving this at the minute for you?
You know, this winter I decided to get a diesel heater. Well, I finally got it installed. They're wonderful machines, actually. And they produce an incredible amount of heat. But, you know, I always thought, well, if this thing's got a combustion chamber, is there a possibility of CO2 leakage or something like that? And we also use propane to cook. You know, we have a propane stovetop. And I've always wanted to kind of keep an eye on this. And I have a lot of these Z-Wave sensors throughout the house, but the one thing they don't do is CO2 detection. They do like everything else, but they don't do CO2. And when you look into specific CO2 sensors, and we'll talk about some more options in a little bit, you know, they can range from you build it with an ESP yourself for $10, $15 tops to $120, $130 devices, depending on what you look at. And so I was looking for something that was pre-built, but and something I could buy a few of so it wouldn't break the bank. And I ended up getting one of these First Alert Z-Wave smoke detectors that is just a really rather innocuous looking smoke detector. You could put it up on your wall and never use any of the smart features. And it has a great CO2 sensor built into it. $40 right off Amazon.
I mean, I'm looking at the packaging for this thing. If this was on the shelf at Home Depot, I wouldn't be any the wiser that it had Z-Wave in it.
No. And you would never, you'd never have to hook it up if you don't want to.
It just looks like a bog standard smoke detector.
Yeah.
Nice.
And what is great is when you do connect it over Z-Wave, Home Assistant picks it right up when you put the thing in pairing mode. And all of the sensor data now comes into Home Assistant, which is great because, you know, then you can do things like generate alerts because perhaps there's a CO2 leak when I'm not home. Very possible. Or, you know, maybe I'm out in the yard or something like that. So I wanted a way to notify myself when there was a CO2 leak. And that's why I wanted it to be on Z-Wave. So that way I could get notifications and be aware of it even when I'm not there.
So how does Z-Wave work? This is a battery powered device, right? Does it work in a similar way to Zigbee, where it's a mesh that has like routers and repeaters with hard line wired, like light switches and stuff? Like, how does that work?
I'm not sure about the exact architecture. I do think you have similar setup where you have like AC devices on Z-Wave are essentially repeaters and strengthen the network. And then battery devices, they're generally more consumers of the Z-Wave network. And this is just AA batteries. And it does say it'll last a year. We'll see. Thankfully, the battery status and low warning level also comes through to Home Assistant.
Nice. So, that's what you
want. That is. So the nice thing I think about Z-Wave is that it's, just in my experience, been really, really rock solid, right? It's running at 900 megahertz. I don't really have anything else running at 900 megahertz. And it just has been the absolute, like, most reliable. I use it to control all of my heating, even the stuff that's down in my water bays that prevents our water from freezing all through winter. I trust that to Z-Wave, and it's been rock solid. So I felt pretty good. Plus, this thing also obviously makes a blaring audible 85 dB alarm. It has a built-in, it's a smoke detector, you know, so it'll also beep itself.
Right. You'd hope it would make a fuss when S hits the fan, so to speak.
Yeah. I thought not good enough, though. I wanted a system that would escalate. So the first thing that happens when the smoke detector gets triggered, either smoke or CO2, push notifications go out. Like, that happens to any of my devices that have the Home Assistant app. Push notification goes out. After a minute, if the alarm isn't silenced, I then trigger all of the sirens in Lady Jupes. And every Wyze camera, every Ring stick-up camera has a siren built into it. So it makes a real ruckus because, you know, collectively there's like 8 of these things all together. And Home Assistant can fire all those off. And then, because why not? I went all the way and I went and got 100 dB. This is a Zigbee siren. It just plugs right into an AC outlet and it just has nothing but noise. Like, it just blasts different 8 different types of alarms. And this I have on the outside of Lady Jupes. And the idea is that after a period of time, if there is some sort of emergency situation inside the RV and nobody has taken action to say situation under control, it starts blaring the outside siren. Because honestly, if there's a fire or something like that, maybe a battery situation, people need to get away from the RV.
Yeah.
So I want them to know, hey, there's a situation here. So I have one in an outside bay that will blare after a period of time outside as well. And I can also trigger that anytime I want. For, you know, right now I could trigger it. So, you know, if I got a notification someone's creeping on the RV, I could fire that sucker off right now. Or if I needed to get the kids' attention and they're not answering the damn phone.
I've got an idea for an extension activity for this escalation of alarms for you.
Yeah.
Well, when the external one triggers, you should probably also allow Levi to leave the building too somehow.
You're right. Pop the door, Levi, exit.
Something
right.
Like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I need a Levi detection sensor. So I will link a couple of sirens, the cheap one, and then there's like an $80 one. The $80 one is nice because it has a whole bunch of more tonal range, so you could also use it as just like a moderately nice-sounding doorbell that isn't crazy loud. Like, you could, anything you can plug into Home Assistant, you could have this thing ping different noises. It also has a built-in battery. So if you lose AC power, this thing can run for a while, for 4 hours, which is kind of nice.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And it's, it, you know, having sirens has been kind of nice, but tying into the smoke detector and CO2 detector, I feel like was probably an obvious next step. It's something that I just had not connected. And the one thing I couldn't really nail, and maybe you know, or maybe people listening know, is I looked up ways to mark the notifications in Home Assistant as time critical, so that way it would bust through like a do not disturb, both on Android and on iOS. Different kind of like little things, you know, critical colon one is what you put in there for iOS or something like that. In the data field of the push notification, you can add these things, these little descriptors, and then supposedly supposed to tell the OS, this is a very urgent notification.
Well, we talked about this a little bit in the last episode when we were using phone calls to break through do not disturb modes and all the rest of it. And Michael Kennessy actually wrote in saying, hey, guys, I'm a long time listener. And Chris, I actually bought your old Synology off you a couple of years back. Still going strong.
Oh, awesome. Good.
He said, listening to the last episode, the guy who makes calls to bypass quiet mode, he goes, well, this is OK, but I use pushover for this. It has different alert types as part of the notifications, and the emergency alert can be set to make noise until you acknowledge it. It's really great.
I like that. Okay.
And I use it so much at work with the on-call team, so they don't have any excuse for missing major alerts. Just my two cents.
All right. I'm going to look into that. That seems like that could be the way to go. Because that's my one concern, is that some sort of emergency is happening at home, and I'm just sitting here with, because when I do a show, I always put it in.
Yeah.
You know, do not disturb mode. So
so that would be pushover at pushover.net, I imagine.
Yeah.
Which is what I've used myself for like alerting all sorts of stuff for years. They've got a very generous free tier, or I certainly used to. So yeah, take a look at it.
I've definitely heard of it before. I will.
So does all of this stuff natively work with Home Assistant then? Is it plug and play?
That's what's great. Yeah, it all does. You don't even need any kind of like hacks, special installation.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it all just plugs right in, either using the Zigbee integration or the Z-Wave integration. And now I've been thinking, I've got sensors everywhere. I've got cameras everywhere. I've got door sensors. I've got sirens. I have everything I need to have an alarm system.
Oh, here we go.
Right? Now, I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I was looking at Alarmo, which is an easy-to-use alarm system integration for Home Assistant. And it gives you a user interface for setting up your own alarm system completely right there in the Home Assistant dashboard. And it consists of three components. You have the Alarmo component, which is the custom component that you have to install. You have the panel, which is a GUI for configuring the settings in your alarm, sensors, delays, and stuff like that. And then an Alarmo card, which is a custom card you could put up like on a tablet or something, which is essentially for just arming and disarming the alarm like any kind of alarm pad would be.
So that presupposes, I guess, that you've got some kind of keypad by the door. I mean, you obviously got the Home Assistant Lovelace card, but could that link up with yet another piece of like physical hardware?
Physical? Yeah, that'd be nice. Like a physical keypad.
Yeah, maybe, like, I don't know. Can you reach USB from your Home Assistant device from there? You could just put like a numpad by the
door. A Bluetooth numpad, maybe.
Bluetooth.
You know, yeah. That could work.
Yeah.
Also, it supports multiple users with individual PIN codes, so like the kids could have their own codes and stuff. Like it's kind of everything I'd want, especially if it, if I get the urgent notification stuff worked out.
I think get the kids to clock in and clock out as they do their chores, you know.
Right. There you go.
I'm sorry, Dylan, you were 3 minutes late. No iPad time for you, son.
Also, it does support different zones. Like in the sense of the RV, you could see the house would be one zone, and then the storage bays could all be a separate zone. If I went as far as putting door sensors on the storage bays, which I have not done, but have considered, you know, you could even have so you could have the house unarmed, but you could have the storage bays armed, which is great. Like when we're at a campground, or
a rest stop or something. Yeah.
Yep. Perfect. Yep. Yeah, I don't know. I'm considering it. Obviously I'm traveling. As this episode comes out, I'm traveling to Scale. And Alex, you're going to be at Scale, right?
Yeah. So I've got a talk on the Saturday.
Yeah. And so we're probably, that's where we're at right now, probably. As people are listening to this, we're probably at your talk right now. Think about that.
Which I haven't written yet.
Oh, man. So if anybody has any experience with Alarmo or any thoughts on this process that I'm considering, I've also seen folks on YouTube, I'm not going to go down this route yet, so I'm just going to save people time. Yes, I've seen the people that go get the alarm systems from the 90s like the one I actually have in the studio, and you can make all of that work with Home Assistant.
No way.
Yeah.
That feels gross.
It's weird. But then it's like, it's, you know, the door sensor technology is magnets, right? It hasn't changed much.
Oh, I suppose.
Yeah. Motion sensors. And then you get a physical pad, you know?
It's time to get physical.
Yeah. So there's that. Also, in just the news of sensors, there's some good news about the Apollo Automation folks and joining the Works with Home Assistant program.
Yeah, Apollo Automation, they're a fairly new smart home company, but they are building a really great reputation for themselves, and they are now officially the first made-for-ESP home, Works with Home Assistant certified automation, home automation partner.
This is great. This is like made, this is perfect for guys like us. I don't need to build all my own sensors, but I'd love it to be built on this technology that I know is solid and works great with the system I have.
They have a range of sensors, from air quality sensors to millimeter wave sensors, radar sensors, plant watering sensors, and also
CO2 sensors.
Yeah, garage parking assistant, like radar. So you could pull into your garage and think, how much further forward should I be pulling? And how, like, have a LED traffic light system. That'd be pretty cool.
That's not a bad idea at all. Little WLED that just boop, 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 boop.
Yeah. And they've just released a temperature probe called the Temp-1. And this thing can actually withstand all sorts of ridiculous temperatures. Like, you can put it inside an oven and it will measure up to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. A bunch of other stuff too. Like, it's really cool. So, like, if you're smoking those meats or whatever, you could actually use this inside your brisket to be a temp probe.
Could you imagine checking the Home Assistant chart for your brisket smoker?
Yes.
Actually, yes.
Yes, I can. So anyway, we've got a couple of products on the bench that I just haven't gotten around to reviewing them yet because the attic's still not done yet. When I'm done up there, I want the lighting to be controlled. Well, first of all, I want it to turn on through a PIR sensor because the response time for PIR is supposed to be better than millimeter wave. So I'll use PIR to turn the lights on, and then I'll use millimeter wave, and I've got a couple of their sensors ready to go for when the attic's done. So watch this space. But, you know, I just wanted to highlight that Apollo Automation have been accepted into the Works with Home Assistant program. And that ensures that certified devices are thoroughly tested, they're compatible, and will receive ongoing support and updates to the standard that Home Assistant requires to be a member of this program. So really, it's just a good way for users to know that they're getting, I suppose, well-supported and reliable products.
Keeb.io/self-hosted, KEEB.io/self-hosted. Head on over there, sign up for the newsletter, and get 5% off your next order. Let's face it, your keyboard might be one of the most important things you own. It took me a while to appreciate that, but I mean, I'm interfacing with it every day, most of the day. It's the primary interface to my computer. And there's a lot of options out there, but I'm kind of somebody who likes a fancy keyboard now. I wasn't always this way, but I've seen the light. Keybio, they range from regular keyboards, and they really specialize in those cool split keyboards. And the keyboards, they'll come fully built, ready to use if that's how you like it, out of the box. Or you can get it as a kit and assemble it, do some hot swapping. There's no soldering for those parts, so it might be a fun project for home, too. Or, you know, if you just want to get started, you can get one that's fully built. The other thing that I think you should look at, and you could kind of up your game a little bit, is their macro pads. With those 9 to 16 keys, you can use them for all kinds of things. You can put phrases on there and have it connected to something like Bitfocus. You could have it control OBS. You know, there's probably a way using the Stream Deck software to tie it in with Home Assistant as well. Or maybe it's a nice way to control your home media PC. I think those are so handy. We have a couple of them right here in the studio. In fact, I've got one right here. I love these little side thing, you know, hook it up over USB. It's pretty great. I think people normally think of mechanical keyboards as loud and clicky, and those do exist, but they also have the versions with silent switches to keep things quiet and low-key in the office or at home, you know. I like my loud typing, I'll be honest with you guys, but not everybody does, or sometimes the people around you don't. They stock lots of DIY parts and microcontrollers, and they're big supporters of open source. They publish the 3D print case parts, and they're also part of the core QMK team. for the firmware. And all their boards use the QMK firmware. I love that. You deserve a great keyboard. Check them out and support the show. Go to keeb.io/self-hosted. That's keeb.io/self-hosted.
So I was on these here YouTubes, and I came across a Network Chuck video about a project called EXO. And then The Holm wrote in saying, hey guys, have you seen this? GitHub.com/EXOExplore. There'll be a link in the show notes. You can unify your existing devices into a single powerful GPU. It allows for the distribution of a model, an LLM model, across multiple physical devices.
Yeah, EXO, and I have seen this, and this is right up my alley. I have always had such a soft spot for distributed compute, and nothing's going to make you feel like you need to upgrade all of your stuff, your storage, your network, everything like EXO will.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can basically give your house a score ranging from GPU poor to GPU rich on the EXO dashboard.
Yeah.
What's cool though is it creates this kind of like picture of your infrastructure and says, you know, your Linux box runs at so many teraflops and your MacBook Pro runs at so many teraflops, and it's like your Raspberry Pi runs at whatever the equivalent of a microflop is.
And it's also, I mean, I haven't tried this extensively because I have very limited options, but my understanding is it's also pretty good at seeing which network interfaces, if you have multiple options and multiple routes, are communicating the fastest amongst the machines, and then picking that for the transmission of, like, you know, loading the model and things like that.
Yeah, I haven't actually had a chance to use this yet, thanks to my server shenanigans this weekend. I'd actually planned to look at this weekend and, you know, c'est la vie.
Yeah, I think we could come back to this because this is, like, right up our alley.
I love that. For sure. What I'd like to test is how good does the network link between those boxes need to be? And let's say there was a GPU in the data center in Toronto and a GPU in Chris's proverbial basement and one in my, like, could we link all of those three together, or do you need to be local? Like, I want to.
And is it that initial load is maybe really long and painful, but then after that it's smaller updates, so it's actually functional?
Yeah. I'm just curious to answer that question, really. And then, like, how distributed can we actually be?
Yeah. Scott wrote in, I'm currently looking for a suggestion about OpenSense versus the Ubiquiti firewall. I listened to all your shows, and I can't remember which one you described your newest home setup. I moved to a new Pro Max 24 PoE when my trusty ICX 6610 started dying. Now, I'm trying to decide if I go full UI or stay with OpenSense. Thanks for your time and the great content.
Well, I made the switch to a UDM Pro something or other. Probably about 2 or 3 months ago. I kind of love it after a bit of time.
Yeah. Okay.
Mostly for VLAN management. I upgraded to it because I thought, well, it'd be nice. I've got Unify switches and access points. It would be nice if I just had like a dashboard that could understand and speak that language for all the data that those switches are collecting and present it to me in one place. But over the last few months, you know, I co-located Shane's server in my basement from a few episodes ago, so he's got his own VLAN, and I can just, you know, from the Unify dashboard, boop, map a couple of ports to his VLAN, physical ports, so he doesn't need to do any tagging on the interfaces. It's got Unify Protect built in for cameras. I just throw a hard drive in there, and it just works even with third-party cameras now using OnViv.
That is nice.
It is really nice. The one real bugbear, like the biggest difference for me of as an end user, of course, OpenSense is a BSD-based thing, and the Ubiquiti firewalls actually underneath run Debian, I think. So I'm sort of thinking to myself, well, I can put Tailscale on the UDM, can't I? Well, technically, yes, you can, but every time you upgrade the firmware, it gets wiped and you have to do it again.
Right.
So the UDMs do support native WireGuard. So if you want to do a site-to-site VPN, they also have their own proprietary Unify VPN stuff that does that, which makes it very nice. So, like, if you're all in on the Unify ecosystem and you have a bunch of switches, absolutely go for it, because it just makes managing the whole network a piece of cake. It it's just a fabulous experience. And apart from the price, really, for what it is, you know, the OpenSense stuff, you'll pay for it in time, configuring VLANs and DHCP this. And yeah, I do.
Sounds
love...
like it kind of comes down to, does he want to be part of the Unify ecosystem? And if is he going to have other products and things in that ecosystem, or is this a one-off? Kind of what it sounds like it comes down to.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better.
Well, let us know what you do. I mean, this is something I'm also kind of considering for the studio. I'm thinking everything from like a tiny SBC NIX box that is a really basic router, because my firewall doesn't do much anymore, to all the way up to something like the Unify system, with the idea of then eventually that'll be the switch in the studio, and then eventually that'll be the cameras in the studio, but, you know, just do it over time. And I haven't made my mind up yet, but I am kind of leaning that direction and then starting with the edge and then kind of building on the other devices from there. So let me know what you do.
Unify just gets increasingly better the more you have, unfortunately. It's one of those it's one of those types of things. You think, oh, well, I could just get a bog standard, simple, unmanaged switch for my desk. Or
right.
Yeah. I could get one where I could tag the ports and all the rest of it. And you're like, well, I'm in this far, I may as well keep going. It's like a Costco membership, you know?
Now, we are recording early this week. In fact, if you're listening right as it comes out, you still have a chance to come say hi at our Saturday dinner at Scale. It'll be on March 8th at 7 p.m. We have details at meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting, and we'd love it if you came and said hi. But as I was just kind of collecting some links, I saw a boost from Adversary 17 came in for 17,000 sats, like literally at just the right moment. And he has a good question that I think I would want to know too. He says, a few weeks ago, I mentioned I might get a Prusa Core 1. Well, I have.
All right.
Congratulations. He says, it should ship this month, but now I've been going down the rabbit hole of filaments. Alex, what do you primarily print with? Any good brands, places to get it, things to look out for? Any tips for, quote, I wish I knew this before I'd done something advice type thing? I'm a total noob, so any and all help would be appreciated.
Well, this is a really great question, because there is nothing beats experience. At least that's what my old man used to tell me, right? Look at these gray hairs. Each one represents something I did wrong. That's why my beard is basically full of gray hairs these days. So I primarily print with a mixture of PLA and PETG filaments. And actually, for the most part, PLA, to be honest. I pick out whatever happens to be the cheapest rolls on Amazon, and I just go with a bog standard boring black filament for most things, like the Gridfinity pots that I've printed 8 bajillion of. I think you can get a roll of Elegoo filament for about $13 or $14 now for a kilo, which isn't too bad. You can go more exotic with like Protopastas, and there's all sorts of brands. I mean, Printed Solid is the local now US distributor of Prusament, and all of these different things. But I've never really found that much benefit from going with a premium supplier of filament versus a more entry level, like just the cheapest ones you can get. A lot of the manufacturers like to use, I don't want to accuse them of marketing their own stuff when that's exactly what they're doing, I suppose, but they talk about like dimensional accuracy of the filament being important as it's extruded through the nozzle and all the rest of it. And of course that stuff does matter to a point, but really you've got to ask yourself the question of like, how much do I actually care about the most perfect print, the most perfect model? Because the reality is, with FDM printing, which is what the Core 1 is doing, and every, you know, sort of bed slinger before it was doing too, you're not going to get prints that are actually perfect. If you want that, you've got to go resin, really. You can do a lot to like sand and smooth prints with acetone and paint them and fill them with like Bondo and filler and all the rest of it. But for the most part, I like to just print things in PLA and just keep it simple. The downside of PLA is it doesn't like getting warm at all. So like if you're going to print something to go inside your car, PLA will soften and go through what's called the glass transition temperature at about 45 Celsius, which means it becomes soft like warm chocolate. It's not actually melting. It just goes really soft. You know, when you've picked up a chocolate bar that's melted, you know exactly what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Whereas PETG, it can be a little more forgiving. It's got a little bit of flex to it. It can handle higher temperatures before it transitions. And, you know, if you're going to make something that's going to take some, that's going to need some give or some flex to it, then PETG is the way to go. I've printed with ABS a few times, and it is the most picky, most difficult, most stinky, horrible stuff in the world. So, yeah, would not recommend ABS. Beyond that, just immerse yourself and have fun. You've bought an amazing machine with the Core 1, I'm sure of it. Prusa's got a reputation for a reason. And, yeah, thanks for writing in, and have fun.
Enjoy your replicator adversaries, and thank you everybody else who does support the show with a boost. We will be reading those when we get back to our regular schedule. And also, I just want to say a really big thank you to our members. You are like the foundation out there. That's why we call you our site reliability engineers. Thank you for your support as well. We have details at selfhosted.show/SRE. You support the show, and as a thank you, you get an ad-free feed and a little extra content. We put a post show on every episode for our members. Again, selfhosted.show/SRE.
One of those sort of behind-the-scenes chats where Chris and I have a radio-polished segment in the main show. The post show gets what we actually think.
Yeah, well, because you're like the lower stakes, man. Not as many people are listening, right?
Right, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. You can go to meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting for details of all of our upcoming meetups, like this week's at Scale in Pasadena.
Yes, and of course, we love hearing from you. You can do that at our website. Lots of links over there. selfhosted.show/contact is the place to go to get in touch and drop us a note.
And you can find me on the internet at alex.ktz.me. That's where my self-hosted link tree lives.
Oh, I like it. I'm just living the wild side over at chrislas.com. And I also respond on WeaponX at chrislas.com as well.
That place is getting increasingly worse and worse. One of these days, Chris, we'll kick the X habit for you.
You know, it's I don't mind the if you just go to I have my bookmark goes right to my replies. It's not so bad.
Oh, okay. So just ignore the main benefit of the anyway. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was selfhosted.show/144.